It is Friday, August 26th, 2005, 10:06 a.m. on the Central Coast of California. Today we're talking with Derek Wise, President and CEO of Global Net Optics, Inc. We're talking about how the Internet works. And, of course, it's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. My name is Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Today, on our program, after a spot of geek news, we're speaking with Derek Wise, the CEO of Global Net Optics, about the Internet, how it works, you know, bandwidth, servers everywhere. We'll take your phone numbers, we'll take your calls if I give you our phone numbers, which I will right now. During the second half of the show, you're welcome to call 476-2800, toll free at 1-800-655-5877, or you can go to geekspeak.org and click on Contact Us. I'll give out that contact information again when I invite your participation in about half an hour. That was kind of a choppy start of Geek Speak today, playing the wrong thing, but it was nice to hear John Tracy. With John Tracy being on that little old promo about memory, which is kind of interesting to hear again, we have, I think, like every geek that's ever been on Geek Speak on today. Well, not really. We're missing Dee Dee, but other than that, we have.
And Chris Dunphy.
And Chris Dunphy, that's true. Okay, so not that.
And John Tracy.
But there are geeks here, as you can hear. So we have Sean Cleveland, Senior PR Marketing Manager for NetCell, Miles Elam, Technical Trainer for Surf Control, Drew Meyer, Storage Specialist at Adaptec, and a new geek, Josh Weiss. Weiss. Okay, good. a personal geek ready for rent or lease. So if you need a geek, you're welcome to contact GeekSpeak by going to geekspeak.org. And Josh in the Monterey Bay area will take care of you.
So if you lease him, do you have to feed him?
Yeah, you have to take care of him completely if you lease him. All right. We're going to get into our topic about the Internet in general and how computers get connected and how computers are housed and owned and controlled. With our guest in just a moment. But first, let's do some geek news. Who's ready? Miles is ready. Miles, go for it, man.
Yes. In Australia, there's a $37 million, that's Australian dollar, investment by Intel in a Australian WiMAX project. WiMAX being a wide area, or not necessarily wide area network, but as opposed to Wi-Fi, which is only measured in hundreds of meters, WiMAX is measured in kilometers. I believe it goes up to about 30 kilometers line of sight, and then otherwise, you know, shorter than that, it's the last, what's known as the last mile.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the biggest expenditure in WiMAX to date, and looks like it may be an impetus for greater WiMAX investment in the future.
Okay, good. If it succeeds.
Well, of course it's going to succeed.
All right.
What are you talking about?
It's the technology one, so it's going to be no problem.
People are going to make it work.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely useful. We have that problem in this area. People call from behind, I need the Internet, and I can't get DSL. So, yes, thanks, Miles, for keeping us abreast on that. Next, you know, Josh, you're looking at me. What's up?
So Google is continuing their bid of world domination this week. They've come out with a bunch of new programs this week. I'll talk about their extension to their desk bar. The desk bar was a little bar on the desktop you could search Google from, but they put out the sidebar this week, which does about everything you could ever want to do.
Everything you could want to do?
Well, you can get news, weather, and stocks with it, but you can also has a built-in RSS aggregator. So you can get all kinds of clips and news, so music and videos can come right to your desktop with it. It'll give you a slideshow of all your photos, which is sort of useless, but cool in a way.
And will it do my dishes?
If you really want, Miles.
My house needs to be painted. So.
So it doesn't do everything.
This actually sounds nicer than the search tool, because the search toolbar basically just gives you search features.
Right.
But
well,
this gives you like an RSS aggregator. Oh. When you say an RSS aggregator, does it actually, you describe which RSS feeds you want aggregated?
Yes, and it also searches RSS feeds that you've used on your computer in the past and pops up clips that you've seen. Cool. And it also gets your email if you have a Gmail account, or it can also integrate with Outlook to search your Outlook, and it searches your computer.
Is this?
Wow. And it takes up about a quarter of your screen space.
Okay. So you liking it? Are you using it?
I just started using it yesterday.
Is it a Windows only thing?
It's a Windows only thing for now.
Does it have an Instant Messenger client?
Well, they also just put out an Instant Messenger client, which is doing the voice over IP thing as well, called Google Talk.
Wow.
But we can come to that next.
That was pretty fast. Okay, we'll go to somebody else. Sean, hi. Hey, you know, Sean, welcome back. You had a little baby, River. She's beautiful. Thanks for coming back in.
Yeah, this is much more difficult than building a computer.
Yeah. How's the sleep?
Building a baby.
Building a baby. Building a baby was okay, but once the baby's in your hands, wow.
It's like feeding and sleeping and walking and...
Sleeping?
So, all right, what's up for the news?
So this week was the Intel Developer Conference up in San Francisco. IDF is a big show where Intel talks about their new technologies, and everybody else kind of goes and...
Listens
and shows off their new technologies. But I think the big news this week was Intel announced their VIIV technology, which is pronounced Vive.
And what is that?
It's supposed to enable PCs with TV-like capabilities. I guess they're working with consumer electronic devices and other companies, and they're pushing, well, turning your PC into a TV. People have been talking about it, but they're coming out with new technology that's supposed to make this easier. One of those is ability to quickly turn it on and off, your computer on and off, with a touch of a button, which they're calling quick resume technology.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of important for a console-based, you know, PC. And also, these things will ship with 5.1 surround sound, and with an optional TV tuner card, you'll be able to record, pause, rewind, like TiVo. But it looks like they're really pushing to get the PC into the living room.
Mm-hmm. So, like everybody else.
So if you see Intel Vive, you'll know what that means.
All right. Thanks, Sean. I'm going to go to you, Drew, though I can't see you. Hi.
How you doing, Lyle?
Good. You've got a nice voice. Welcome back from your break. What's up, man?
I'm scrambling for a little bit of news here. I was actually at the Intel Developer Forum yesterday.
Oh, yeah. How was it?
It was interesting. There's so many hardcore geeks that are there, developers, people who are looking to build software that runs on people's chips, and there's all kinds of booths with chips and stuff showing. But Adaptec was up there showing off our serial attached SCSI technology, some of the first actual demonstrative units that are running in real life, where you have the latest generation of storage technology actually in a booth running live with the lights blinking and the data transferring. So we were surprised at how much interest there was in that. And I guess that's the next generation of coming in storage and interfaces.
Now, there's a lot of enterprise storage. Is that
enterprise storage? That's really going to, like, in our data center discussion today, I expect we may come across some storage discussion and SAS, serial attached SCSI, is the type of storage that will be used in a data center. So when you connect to Google and check your Gmail account through your Google toolbar, you're actually looking at data that's probably going to be coming off of a SAS storage subsystem.
Yeah, completely separate from the server.
Right, back in the data center somewhere.
We'll talk about today with Derek.
Well, let's go on to one more round of news.
And yeah, why don't you just talk to Miles? Miles has a bunch of news.
Yeah. Help us out here, Miles. Do us a favor.
Miles, what's up, man?
Okay, CBS News covered this. University of Texas, their main library, is getting rid of books.
Getting rid of books.
Getting rid of books?
Good thing for a library to do.
you really can't go to the library anymore.
They're converting the library to, quote, a social gathering place more akin to a coffee house. Instead of racks and racks of books.
Sure, let's go to that library.
Okay, but they're not getting rid of all their books, are they?
Probably not all. I mean, okay. Assuming not all of them.
Personally,
however,
I like hanging out in environments with books. I mean, that's
right,
a nice
right.
thing.
So sad.
It's saying that the missing books are going to be replaced with colorful, overstuffed chairs for lounging, bar stools for people watching, and booths for group work.
IKEA comes to libraries.
In addition to the almost 250 desktop computers, there will be 75 laptops available for checkout, wireless internet access, computer labs, software suites, multimedia studio, computer
health. Oh, we're not laughing now, are we?
Cafe.
Wow.
So are they putting all their out-of-print books online then? You know, in their database?
I don't know, but...
Sean, you're out of room. You have a baby. I know. It seems kind of, crazy.
Yeah, I mean, what if there's a volume you need? You look, you know, you dig up online and it says, hey, this book has the information you need.
I know that a lot of libraries...
But it's not available anymore.
Like, for example, the Library of Congress has for years been scanning books, and especially ones that are rare or, you know, crumbling or out of print. Wow, I'm getting a lot of echo there. But at the same time, the thing that I would like to see is something that was more like the book interface, like the e-book style, something that was easier to handle, because that's something that's missing. A laptop just isn't the same as holding something in the size of your hand.
It never will be. I mean, there's nothing. Nothing's going to be
is
a digital screen.
Is that necessarily true? Because there is electronic paper coming out. There is the form factors are going smaller. It is you can have, or there is the technology for a paperback style,
you know,
electronic device.
You know, I'm kind of feeling like, I mean, we've been doing Geek Speak for like 5 years this month, and And I think we were talking about paper displays 5 years ago. And I don't want to say that it's just like flying cars, but I don't know.
We all know what you mean when you say that.
Yeah, I mean,
but you know, can you imagine something that's the size of a paperback book?
You know, I can imagine, and a lot of people can imagine it, but I don't think it exists.
The internet is the internet is a great place. It's like it's a great place to search for books, and it's great reference.
Get
but
the leads, yeah.
Yeah, you know, I don't know if I'd trust the content people have written up there.
Well, not, you know, the good thing is not every library will do this, of course.
Right, but this isn't just like going to a web page. This would be, for example, you're looking at Joseph Conrad, Heart or Darkness.
You know, if that's the case, I think it's great. Because can you imagine having search capabilities?
The library's not doing that. The library's just getting rid of a whole bunch of books and making a coffee shop so they can keep their
But will they have
flow.
Like a little aromatic smell? It's like old, must be book smell they can spray around in there.
Maybe they'll flavor the different areas, but like the book sections as well, you know?
Smell-o-vision.
You'll have to disable your speakers, no talking.
Yeah. You can have coffee, but don't talk.
Kind of weird.
All right,
social environment where everyone wears headphones all the time.
Thank you, Miles, for that story about libraries not having books. What is the world coming to?
Yeah.
Josh, what's up?
I guess we can continue the Google Talk.
Yeah, okay. Well, continue.
Well, so Google Talk came out this week, and this is their new instant messaging program, which it does everything Instant Messenger does, plus it has voiceover IP capability. So you can talk to all of your Gmail friends. It's only for Gmail people right now.
Right.
But I was reading this morning kind of a cool thing you can do with it is you could send music or podcasts through it and send them to your friend that you're talking to on Gmail by just unplugging your mic and running the wave out.
Different audio source.
Yeah,
uh-huh.
And it's running the wave out through your Google Talk. So it's sort of like your new radio broadcast for one.
For individuals.
Yes.
Or I guess for groups because you can do group talk as well.
It was saying that if you put people on, if you switch users, you only get one at a time to do that. I don't know. I haven't tried it yet.
Okay.
And it's compatible with any Jabber client? Is that the case? Okay.
Yeah.
Jabber is another Instant Messenger protocol, just like AOL Instant Messenger, Yahoo Instant Messenger. There's Jabber.
Right. So we'll find out about that. But it's interesting that they're competing with voice over IP now.
With, like, Skype, which is the big boy right now for the free speaking kind of thing.
And everyone's going to have it, and everyone's not going to have Skype pretty soon.
Yeah, that's true. All right, thank you, Josh. Sean?
Let's move on.
Let's get on with this, huh?
Get on with the show,
All right, enough of this whole geek news. I want to thank you guys, all of you, Miles, Josh, Drew, and Sean, for doing the geek news with us today. Derek Weiss is the president and CEO of Global Net Optics, Inc., a data center, internet service provider, and hosting provider. They host, among other things, the Oakland Raiders and geekspeak.org. Imagine that. So we invited Derek to come over the hill to the nice side of the hill, if you will, to Santa Cruz. And Derek, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Great. Thank you.
So, Derek, we're going to talk about, I mean, you're kind of a geek expert. When you came in this morning, you were here already before I got here. As the geeks started getting here and not having net connectivity through our wireless, you helped them out. Drew, do you have net connectivity now?
This has nothing to do with the capabilities of Net Optics, but I'm afraid not.
Okay, so you couldn't help everybody.
No, I couldn't help everyone. No.
But, Derek, you definitely are a geek, and we welcome you to come out to talk about the Internet in general. When people ask me how the Internet works, the general response I have is a whole bunch of computers connected together, which is a good definition, if you will. But let's talk first about the connection points. It was created by the military. Can you give me a little history on it, please?
So I guess the first place the Internet really started was on a paper napkin.
Get a little closer.
ARPANET.
ARPANET, right.
So it was actually, I think it was NASA Ames Research Facility. I think some guys from Cal Berkeley. I don't have the complete history in my head right
now. It's fine.
But it was basically a mesh network that was put together to send text file emails to one another. And I think they mainly wanted to do it to goof off to start with.
And when it was very young, you had, like, specific connection points. There was a few. And as they got added, everybody knew what they were. But now we have, like, I've got a connection point in my house that people can go to through a web page. So how has it grown to that point? And what are the, like, I hear these terms May East, May West. You want to be connected to one of those? What is that?
So what a May is, it's a metro area exchange. And your general description of the Internet is correct in some ways that every computer basically connects to another. But it's not connected directly. Your computer at home is not connected directly to my computer at home.
Darn it.
You know, for cost reasons and just because I don't want to have you touching my computer.
Right, of course.
But data centers are where this happens at, and the aggregate points in the Internet. This is where very, very large, expensive pipes can be brought down and shared, and multiple carriers and networks can connect to one another in a cost-effective manner. It's money kind of drives everything. I'm sure if you could afford to, you'd buy a 100 meg circuit to my house. But
I don't know, to your house, but
maybe
somewhere.
But the internet's just more expensive to operate that way, so this is why the aggregation points come into play. And so the metro area exchanges are places where carriers can communicate with one another and drop off free peering traffic. And this has expanded from that into peering switches now. So there are whole companies that run around nothing doing but peering. So Palo Alto Internet Exchange, for example.
So all they do is peering, which means they've got a really some big pipes coming in. They make sure that they talk to each other effectively.
A little bit more than that. It's more like a hostess of sorts. You know, you bring in a whole bunch of carriers, you set them all together in a room, you put a big switch in the middle, and you say, go wild. And all the carriers are allowed to transmit traffic over the switches to one another in a more cost-effective manner, increasing the capacity of the Internet, but making that point in space a very important point in Internet space.
So physical, there is important physical space. Because, look, when we do Internet stuff, normally we don't care about physical stuff. It doesn't really matter where things are. But these points matter because there is hardware.
Yeah, the internet is physical. It's not this ether old thing.
For you, it is.
It's very physical. You know, it's hundreds and thousands and millions of square feet of co-location and forced air and electricity that keeps these things running. Computers today are much more dense, much more power consuming. Internet services is just growing. Even with the dot-com bomb, there's still the growth and need and demand for more internet service that hasn't slowed down at all. So these centers continue to grow.
Okay, so these centers, which either they're just bandwidth centers or they're like server hosting for websites or for email, for other things, these are all called data centers?
Yeah, in general, they're all called data centers. Each one has different focuses. Some data centers are very much for the web hosting and racks and servers of equipment. And other data centers are more for switches and routers, more for the carriers to come in and play and do business there.
Where does May West touch down?
So May West is on the corner of Market and Post Street, 55 South Market in San Jose.
It really has a location.
It is a 16-story gold glass building in downtown San Jose.
What's in it?
A lot of computers and servers.
And copper and fiber.
And the IRS. Believe it or not, the IRS exists there, too. So
I totally believe that.
Coincidence?
But,
I think not.
No. So they have like a 3-story elevator ride to get to my office and, you know, get their check. Anyway.
Do you service the IRS?
No, we don't service the IRS.
But you service a lot of big companies.
Yeah, we have a lot of large companies that we do business for. So the Oakland Raiders, Symantec is one of our customers as well.
Brightmail,
their anti-spam software we do a lot of work with.
Okay.
Right now we have about 300 small to medium enterprise clients in our network, and we're a multi-gigabit infrastructure system.
And GeekSpeak, of course, is there, too.
Of course, our number one, largest,
largest
most important customer, GeekSpeak Radio. They're what keep us really running.
At least the next 40 minutes.
Yeah.
So if you want to ask a question of our guest, you're welcome to use his bandwidth. Go to geekspeak.org and click on Contact Us, and we'll answer that question on there. In a few minutes, I'll be inviting people to call in as well. Now, Derek, the issues of running a data center, I mean, if you go in there, one of the things you notice is it's really, really cold and it's windy.
That's because the whole back wall is an air conditioner.
It's crazy. When we went in last time to work on it, Miles and I went on to work on our dead hardware. It had nothing to do with what you provide. It was just our bad hardware that was finally dying. Miles and I forgot. I mean, one of us forgot to bring a jacket. We were freezing.
Yep. Yeah.
You got a jacket. That's right. You brought jackets.
I remembered from last time.
That's right. We get out of his car, and he's like, here, take a sweater. I'm like, what? Take a sweater. Oh, right. It's so cold in there. So is that one of the major things is the environment?
Yeah, cooling is a big deal today. Each computer is a little different. Each server is a little different. But with the higher-end processors and the more power going through chipsets, and the more dense the equipment's getting, now one rack units and even blade systems, much more heat in a smaller space, so we really got to pump up the air conditioning all the time.
And a blade system is a...
So a blade server is something smaller than a rack unit. It's usually more dense than that. So the systems that we have installed, 14 servers fit into a 7-rack unit space. A rack unit's about 1¾ inches, so you can do the math yourself, I guess. But basically, I can fit 84 servers into a single cabinet with about 168 total processors in the environment.
That's
a lot of heat created in a very small little environment. So the colder, the better. If you walk into a data center and it's not cold, there's probably a problem. You need a sweater in a data center, or it's not a good...
Now, if it's Okay, so that's one telltale sign. That's a good thing to know. In that server, that means if you're producing a lot of heat that you need to get rid of with a lot of air conditioning, that means you've got to have a lot of power. So how's the power dealt with?
Power is probably the largest single concern that we see in data centers today. Colo space, it got cheaper with the dot-com bomb because there was so much built up. But power didn't. Power still goes up in cost. And the denser these systems are getting, they're saving some space on the footprint, but the cost of operating in a high-cost electricity environment like the San Francisco Bay Area, it just hasn't come down. So right now, $10 to $12 a breaker to amp is the average kind of means that these things fall into. And it's not getting cheaper. So regardless of how dense the computing gets, it's really about the efficiency of the system. So buying good hardware, good power supplies that efficiently use the power.
So do you when you rent out a whole rack, which is like a kind of freestanding closet, if you will, that has an iron, has a gate around it and has a locking system and has a whole bunch of servers stacked in it. When you sell or lease one of those spaces to somebody, do you also manage the amount of electricity they use and charge them for that, or how does that?
Yeah, correct. I mean, it's different depending on the customer requirements. Everyone needs something a little different. But most of our data centers, we are able to offer either a flat rate billing solution for power, or some of our customers will go on a metered system where they pay for what they actually use.
Hmm. So in flat rate situation, kind of like, okay, you have access to this 20-amp breaker, therefore you're using that much, quote, bandwidth of amperage, if you will.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's the same type of thing where you kind of monitor. I mean, if they trips, then they're using too much power.
You know, but with a dedicated circuit, it's basically go for it, do whatever you want to on it. You're paying a flat rate. And then we make the guess on how much we think we're going to use to bill them for.
So it's a lot of management, a lot of things you have to do to make a data center work. All right, well, I appreciate you make it work because I appreciate us having a server there. Now, most people don't concern themselves with hosting servers, but for those of you geeks listening to Geek Speak who are interested in colo, of course, GNI, Global Net Optics Inc., offer those services. So netoptics.com. I'm just going to spell it out: netoptex.com. If you want to learn more about the company, we are now going to invite people to call in. So if you'd like to call in, please do. The phone numbers are 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Of course, you can use the Internet. Go to geekspeak.org and click on Contact Us. This program is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts, as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. And I have nothing set up here, so I'm going to pass the mic to Miles, and Miles, tell me something interesting.
Hey, you know what? We actually have a question already, email from a listener. It says, this is from Gabe in Pacific Grove. He says, could you guys please address the privacy issue talking about data centers? How good are the anonymizers? How safe are you really when you are logged in onto a bank's website and making entries into their form? Is there any program that allows you to see how you are being routed while going to a site? And can you know if a spammer is watching?
Wow, that's a lot of questions.
Yeah, that's a lot of questions.
That also has kind of like two different parts. When you're talking about a data center, that's talking about the physical location, as opposed to you're talking about...
He kind of wants to know more about privacy, about when you hit a web page and you're giving your personal information.
Yeah, the short answer as far as...
Like, you know what? Let's do that short answer in a second, because I got to do this.
Hey, speaking of this American Life.
I was 6 or 7 when I found out how small our country was. I was the last one to know in my class.
A brand new story by Nick Hornby about a country that's just a field, a village, one shop, and a cafe.
Anyone could invade us tomorrow if they wanted to, but no one wants to. No big countries need an extra field, a shop, and a cafe.
This week, on Public Radio International.
Catch This American Life Sunday at 10 a.m. on Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP.
This program is supported by a grant from CruiseIO, providing local and nationwide internet services, including DSL 6.0, spam filters, and virus protection. Information about CruiseIO membership is available online at cruiseio.com or by calling 459-6301. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. You're listening to Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxel. The geeks this morning: Miles Elam, Josh Weiss, Sean Cleveland, and Drew Meyer. And, of course, our guest is Derek Weiss, the CEO of NetOptics. And Miles, yeah, that sounds good. Go for it.
Santa Cruz branch of the NAACP holds their 2005 annual Labor Day picnic with live music, games, and home-cooked barbecue from 12 noon to 5 p.m. on Sunday, September 4th at De La Viega Park. Information is available at 429-2266.
You are welcome to call in now and join the conversation about data centers or any geek question. We can handle anything. The phone numbers are 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877, or go to geekspeak.org and click on Contact Us.
It's actually Josh Wise is the geek, and our guest is Derek Wise. So talking
Thank
about
you, Mr. Cleland.
Yeah, Cleland. So talking about data centers, specifically we were talking about these questions that we got from this email from from Gabe in Pacific Grove. Anonymizers with data centers.
Well, anonymizers are a completely different thing, though.
Yes,
if you're talking about...
What's an anonymizer? I've never heard of such a thing.
Well, an anonymizer, you'll have a series of servers, or series of clusters of servers, more commonly, where you'll have a group of companies that are all working together to make this entity. And basically, you make a connection to one company, and then they make a connection to another company, and another connection to another company, and then make the connection out to wherever you're trying to go. And that connection is never the same every time you go through.
So it's a bunch of different hops, and it's never consistent.
Right, and they're keeping...
to hide IP addresses. Right. To hide
right.
where you are. Okay.
And so it... Yeah, and so it keeps you from... Keeps it from ever knowing, okay, when a connection was made to this web server, it was done by this person. As long as the companies keep that information private within each other, and no single entity within that anonymizing corporation knows either, because they're in sufficient hops for that.
It's and only and no logging.
If you had more than one, like, in collusion, then they'd be
okay.
able to tell.
So what about more like the situation in security? That's kind of where I think he's getting to. If I have access to the hosting facility and some bank website's there, couldn't I just, like, connect to it and get the data? Is that kind of what he's asking about?
Yeah, he just wants to know how safe you really are when you're logged on to a bank's website and you're putting your personal information in it.
Derek, do you host any banks?
Yeah, we have some financial institutions on our network.
How secure are they?
They're extremely secure. They don't. Most of the banks don't play, you know, very soft games when it comes to financial transactions.
You think?
No, they're very careful about it. There's always a risk when processing your credit card number and your account number and your Social Security number online. There is a potential to be watched. But there's SSL helps a little bit here. A lot of other security and authentication methods they put in place to help protect the circuit that you're coming over.
Well, we talk about SSL quite a bit on the show, that it's really important when you're doing transactions, putting passwords and stuff, to have secure socket layers enabled. And you can tell by having the lock symbol on your browser working in HTTPS in the browser, and not saying ignore this error. You know, pay attention to the errors about security. So, but when we talk about, we say there's a web server, some data center somewhere, and it has a key. And when you're using SSL, no one else can see it except for that server and you. But that server is hosted in your box, and sometimes that server is actually a lot of servers, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a little more complicated than that. So, what actually has those certs, and why couldn't like you or disgruntled employer or something go in there and get into that box?
Well, that's your trust in your financial institution, that they're doing their job correctly. They should have secure servers and password procedures and ways to make sure that disgruntled employees don't mess with people's financial information.
And you see that when you're dealing
with them. It's a standard operating procedure for banks to make sure that they have these kind of checks and balances in place. The smaller the bank, the more risk that you might run with processing financial transactions online.
But there's the whole thing of, you know, even if you get access to the physical environment, you've got to get into their cage. There's alarm systems. There's cameras. People are watching
you. And
that's
what data centers are all about. A good data center has physical and administrative security. So it's even support on site. You have to authenticate who you are before we can do work on your behalf.
Right.
As well as if you come on site, photo IDs. Most of our data centers, you'll have to actually exchange a photo ID in exchange for a badge. So
you can't
know
leave
who you
and
are.
Take off. And,
you know, even a name spelling error is a big enough situation not to let someone into the facility. So,
safe is what the answer is.
And let's keep some perspective. I mean, when you're buying something over the phone, you're giving someone your credit card number. When you go into a business and you run your credit card, then they can look at the receipt and, like, look at it, or, like, look at your card. And
it's probably safer online.
Well, I would say highest risk for data loss is on the person's home computer.
Right.
Trojans and virus on the home computer are the first place that I would look for the potential to, you know, those transactions being sniffed.
I think we'll go back to that email because there's so many questions. Maybe we'll get another question from it. But let's go ahead right now to Watsonville. Welcome, John, to GeekSpeak.
Oh, hi. Thanks a lot for taking my call. I just had a brief comment on the history of the Internet. You were talking about that sort of at the beginning. You probably know that the motivation for designing the Internet was to create a network that could survive a nuclear attack.
We hear that all the time in the creation of the Internet. Yeah.
Decentralized
yeah.
network.
Mm-hmm. It's an interesting point. Thanks a lot.
Oh, certainly. Thank you. Hey, okay, what would happen if one of these major hubs went down, like May West went down because of something catastrophic?
Yeah, we think about it all the time.
You do? How just, depressing.
We see you know, in light of the most recent terrorist events and things that are going on, you think about where they're bombing and the problems that are and what infrastructure they're looking at targeting. And give an example, there's a building in Los Angeles called One Wilshire. I think 70-some-odd percent of the United States international telecommunications traffic goes through that building. So not that the whole world would come to an end or that the Internet would collapse altogether, but a significant portion of it would be delayed or there would be a slowdown on the entire network from one single point. There's about 6 points to 7 points in the United States that are significant Internet point presences.
Yeah, the network traffic could be rerouted, I'm assuming, to a large extent.
Yeah, it could be rerouted, but...
be a bottleneck and add latency?
It would be a bottleneck, it would add latency, and also a lot of companies aren't diverse in their Internet infrastructure. So some companies with only one connection are down when
right.
that one connection is down.
But that's
so,
not you.
That's not me.
So how do you handle that? Let's say with your traffic on your like GeekSpeak, for example, very mm-hmm. important thing here. If our if One Wilshire, is that what it is?
Yep.
One Market, One Wilshire. It goes down for some reason, like this major power outage of the building. Do you still have bandwidth?
Yeah, it's a different methodology the way we operate our internet. So instead of going to AT&T and just buying internet from them and then reselling it to you guys for the
the wonderful profit
yeah, margin, the wonderful margin
from us,
on
right,
the KSP huh? server, but. Instead of just buying from one carrier, we actually buy from four. We multi-home them together, blend the bandwidth, and deliver it out to you from multiple routers.
Okay, so you would just see a down.
We would just see a capacity shift and 180 milliseconds of latency.
Yeah, just to back up multi-homing. Just because I'm sure people heard multi-home and went, what?
So a multi-home is whenever, I got to do another buzzword too, BGP, Border Gateway Protocol is used. That's what the Internet actually runs on is BGP. And it's a protocol that allows us to announce who we are and where we are to multiple entities on the Internet and tell them how to get to us. And if a route isn't available, they can use that same transaction method to change to a different route.
So that's how the routing actually works.
But I have a question. Who maintains all that? Who figured all this out, and how does it all keep running with everybody acting in self-interest?
That's a good question.
Money.
Well, BGP was protocol was designed very early on. From my opinion, BGP is a very arcane protocol, too. It doesn't actually do everything it should be able to do in today's Internet. There are additional protocols that are coming out in the future. I believe Sockeye is one of them. But just like IPv6, the whole world has to be changed to implement it. So, good luck getting it there.
I want to get into IPv6.
Oh, how deep the rabbit hole goes.
Yeah.
But let's invite people to
rabbit,
call.
Right?
Let's go ahead and invite people to call in with questions and comments that maybe some people can understand. So the phone numbers are 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877, or go to the Internet, visit geekspeak.org and click on Contact Us. Now, I want to stress that if you're feeling like you're lost in your computer right now, if you call this number, we will have something to say. It might not be accurate, but we will be able to help you. So
you get what you pay for on GeekSpeak.
If it's not
radio.
Accurate, it'll be funny, hopefully. So the phone number is, if you would like to call in with any questions you have about technology, and I do mean anything, try to stump us. Go for it. 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Of course, you can do this via email. Go to geekspeak.org and click on Contact Us. Okay. What were we talking about before I lost? Oh, yeah. So, Miles, you want to ask him back where we got stuck, where we were just were, because I've lost my train of thought. Please, Miles.
Well, we were just going down the rabbit hole and doing acronym
That's
after
right.
acronym. And
IP version 6. So what's going on?
Leaving our audience in the dust.
While we wait for someone who actually has a question that most people can understand, the question, at least the question, tell us about that, please.
Well, you... Tell you about IPv6.
IPv6. Like, is it going anywhere? Is it happening?
I mean, it is going. It's just going to be slow.
Well, first of all, what is IP version 6?
Okay, so IP version 6 is here for a real significant reason. If you are an internet service provider that happens to be listening in, or if you're another person that's gone out and trying to get your own public IP addresses from your provider, you'll know how painful it is to get that today because there is actually a shortage of IP space available on the internet because of short-sightedness.
MIT hugged all the assets.
Exactly. Well, they gave Class A's or very large chunks of Internet space away to government organizations prematurely before they realized how big the Internet could possibly be. IPv6 fixes the quantity problem day one. So I think our company's current IPv6 LUM is 9 billion IP addresses. And that's
you get that allotment?
That's the IPv6 allotment.
If it were to build that up in 3 years or 4 years?
It's not possible. So what they want to do is they want to make IP space permanent. So once you are assigned a space, it's yours. It's portable. It doesn't go anywhere. And there's no finagling and proof of reason or reasoning to have to require new space.
And we're basically talking about those numbers we hear sometimes that websites are actually are at. The
exactly.
DNS
the
kind
public,
of
the public IP address. So when you're at home on your DSL, it's like a 1010 or 192 network. Those are private IP spaces. This is the public space that's routable on the Internet.
Yeah, and also to give some context, we are currently using IP version 4.
Yep.
That's okay. What most people are using. So when they say IPv6, it means IP version 6.
Now, when you said MIT has a lot of the IP version 4 IPs, how many do they have and why do they have that many?
They have a few Class A addresses.
I think a couple of Class A's.
How many IP addresses is Class A?
So there are 255 total Class A's on the Internet.
It's only 255.
Yeah. So it's just giving you.
So what's 1/255th of 4 billion?
Yeah, a lot.
A lot. They don't have that many machines or that many students. Okay. We're going to go.
They were instrumental in building up the infrastructure for
exactly.
The Internet, and so that's why they.
So it was the good old buddy policy, the good old boy policy at the very beginning. Routing is established that way, too. That's one of the problems with BGP, as well as that's the way the Internet was divided up to begin with.
Yeah, but I don't see them donating any addresses.
No. Once you have IP space and IPv4, no one ever wants to let go of it. It's kind of the way it works.
All right, from Watsonville, maybe a question that people will be able to understand. Bob, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Yeah, thanks. I just kind of have probably a mundane question, but I have an iMac that's like 4 years old, and I have two different browsers, and the one, Internet Explorer, I'm unable to download the Adobe Acrobat files.
Unable to view them?
Well, it just won't download. It comes up like with a skull and crossbones when I try and download the stuff.
That's a bad sign.
Well, but then I have a Netscape 4.7. And when I run that, it'll download the files and it'll be fine.
Right on.
So
now get it. Are you running OS 9?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. So OS X, the way of the future on Mac. Have you tried Safari?
No, I try.
Safari's only available on OS
9.
Yeah, because I had to go to the Mozilla Firebird, and that was unavailable.
No, they don't. Yeah, they don't have any builds of it. Yeah.
Yeah, I think. Unless you're going to install like Windows 3.1.1 or something very old or Windows 95, you're kind of dealing with an operating system that's not really being supported properly
right.
anymore.
I think Opera does.
Maybe Opera?
Yeah.
But you have to pay for that.
You might want to get a paid browser like Opera. I think Opera might.
Yeah,
might
Opera does on OS 9.
Because I used to be able to download off my, down on my Internet Explorer.
Oh, so why is it broken?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I don't know. good question. Let's see. You're getting a skull and crossbones. It seems like a very odd.
Yeah, because I have the Acrobat Reader in my computer because Netscape will function perfectly. But
when Netscape does this, does it download to the local desktop and then launch a separate application, or does it show up in the window?
It downloads onto the desktop, and then I just open up the file on the desktop.
Yeah. Well, so when you're downloading a PDF, this is just a silly response, but when you're downloading a PDF in Internet Explorer on the Mac, instead of clicking on it and letting it launch and give you an error, hold down the control key and click on it. You'll get a little menu and say save to file system or save to computer, save linked file to computer, something like that, and then save it to your desktop and then go and double click it.
Okay, so I just have to press. So basically, when I want to download it, I press the control key.
Hold down the control key, and that's akin to clicking on the right mouse button, which you probably don't actually have a right mouse button, but holding the control key is like that.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you very much for the call.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Bye-bye.
We should probably point out Lyle is on a Mac, too. So
that's true.
He's an expert here.
I don't know about that. I haven't played with an OS 9 for... I don't think I've ever played with OS 9. I think I skipped that operating system. Okay, let's go to Big Sur. Big Sur is... It's so great to hear from Big Sur because no FM stations can get there, so it's so fun to invite Jim on. Jim, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi, guys.
On KUSP. What's up?
I am, by the way, I'm glad to get you out here from your translator. I really appreciate that. I'm about to purchase Photoshop CS2. I have a lot of processing of photos to do, getting ready to make high-quality prints.
Okay.
Let me interrupt you for just a second.
Sure. You'll be glad to know that the entire month of September on GeekSpeak is Digital Photography Month. So we'll be talking a lot about that. But go ahead and ask your question, please.
Okay. I have at least, well, I've heard this all my life, as well, as long as there's been Mac computers, but I have a couple of people telling me, look, you can't get Photoshop and put it on your PC. You need a Mac because the Mac platform, the operating system, everything was conceived, developed, and built with graphics and photos in mind. And it's so much better.
People telling you this happen to own Macintosh computers?
Yeah, and actually, this is Derek. I've got a direct comment for that. That's incorrect. I currently have the CS2 version, just purchased it. It's installed on my AMD processor, Windows XP desktop at home right now. The only thing I'd recommend to you is RAM. Get as much RAM as you can possibly shove into your machine.
No matter what platform you're on.
Yeah, especially with the photo applications. A decent graphics card will help too, but I think the biggest hog for me, I think my desktop has about 2 gigs of RAM in it, and it still eats it all up.
And if you can put your Scratch folder on a separate hard drive, that helps too.
But let me ask you, Jim, are you currently using a Mac or Windows machine for your machine?
Windows.
Okay, so you're on a Windows platform. You're about to invest a lot of money on Adobe products, Photoshop CS2, and see people are saying, oh, no, you should buy a Mac as well to add to the cost.
Yeah, yeah.
Don't do that.
Yeah.
I mean, I get that completely. There is a big thing when you're on a Mac versus a Windows machine. For example, if you're a regular Mac user and you go and look at the same file on a Windows machine, you're automatically going to have a major color problem because you're not used to the gamma settings. But that has nothing to do with what actually is going on with the processing of the files. So you just have to understand that color space is very complex, and I don't even understand it. We're going to have a whole show dedicated to that.
This guy I'm talking to has a $1,500 color calibrator.
Right.
Yeah, for his monitor.
And he knows how to use it on Macs, because he has them.
Is he available in September to talk to us? No.
But you can do the same thing with the PC, right?
Absolutely. There are a couple of calibrators out for PC right now. You can go pick them up at your local electronics store.
And they come with many video cards, actually. Yep.
Are you happy with your current Windows machine?
Pretty happy, yeah. I've used both. I've used Mac and Windows on and off all along. And actually, my Apple crashed a heck of a lot more than my Sony ever does.
If you're happy with your Windows operating system, do not change operating systems for an application like Photoshop.
Yeah.
It's on both platforms. Adobe is very good at testing on both platforms.
Uh-huh.
You're going to run into different problems on each of the platforms, no matter what happens, and a lot of the same problems. So it really doesn't matter. That's
get a
not
right-click
a
button on a Windows box.
But the point is, it's possible to reach the same level of quality of calibration and color matching from photo to file to screen to printer with a PC or with a Mac, either way.
Absolutely. The only problem that you're going to have is that the friend that you know knows a lot about color calibration won't be able to help you. That's the only thing that's going to be problematic.
Because he knows it about Mac.
And he'll complain and moan about it the entire time. So just find somebody else.
Okay. Gentlemen, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Good luck.
Thank you.
Okay.
You know, that said, I do use a Macintosh at work and a Windows machine at home, and I really like the Mac OS operating system. But the other day, one of the students that I know at UCSC, just finishing his master's in computer science, comes in the office with a Windows laptop, goes, hey, boot this. Okay, so I boot it, and it prompts up with, what operating system? Do you want Windows or OS 10? Oh, OS 10. And it launched, and all the apps worked, and it was really, really fast, and it was running a 1.3 gig processor, Intel. And it was great. It was the OS, Mac OS on a Windows machine. It ran great. I was pretty impressed. So in a year, this question won't even be an issue. But Apple's still going to charge more for their hardware. So in any case, let's
go. And it'll still look better, too.
It'll still look better. Look how beautiful it is, folks. Oh, yeah. The glory.
Lyle, stop stroking your PC.
It's not a PC. Okay.
I'm sorry. Your platform.
From Watsonville, Kevin, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hello.
Hi.
I don't really have a computer question, but I did enjoy your disclaimer where you said, you know, we hope to be accurate, and if not accurate, at least we'll be funny. And I really appreciate this honesty, which you would only get on public radio. Wouldn't it be refreshing if we heard such a disclaimer, say, on a commercial evening news or from an elected representative?
Unfortunately, they're not always funny.
We promise to be inaccurate and depressing.
I wonder. And unfortunately, when they're trying, when they're funny, they're usually not trying to be.
Right. Yeah. So did we satisfy either of that criteria? I mean, were we funny or accurate at all?
Or just wrong?
Well, I wasn't listening to your last answers because I was nervously waiting in the queue to talk to you. But usually I would say that you're helpful.
Well, thanks, man.
But not funny.
Yes, and funny. And I enjoy the show.
Thanks. Remember us at pledge time. We appreciate that.
Thank you very much, Kevin.
But there's always the Daily Show, too. Right?
Where our generation gets its news from.
And okay. when polled, end up giving the right answer.
All right. Well, Kevin, thanks for calling in from Watsonville to just give us praise, which is kind of a nice thing to do. Let's get back to that email. Do we have any other emails? I'm actually not checking email because
we don't. But let's talk a little about hardware. I mean, if you're if you want to get your computer into a data center and you do co-hosting, you will allow people to do that. I mean, what caliber computer do you need to host a nice website?
Well, whatever suits your needs, really. Depends on the operating system you're running, and the you know, if you just want to run a basic website, anything even down to a PC, you know, what you have at home can be put into a data center, and what you get from the data center is more reliable power, more reliable cooling, and more reliable internet service with actual bigger capacities and faster networks.
And static IP addresses,
right? And static IP addresses and all kind of great things that make it easier to operate on the internet in a data center. If you're going to go in a data center and you want to do something substantial, that's when you start looking for rack-mounted equipment. So when you're buying at any of the websites that you can go buy hardware from, go check on the rack-mount equipment box.
But it's like four times as much as money.
Yeah, but it saves you about three times the space.
Okay.
So
you're paying for space.
That's only important to you. Why do I care about that?
Well, actually, you're going to care because I'm going to bill you for the space.
Okay.
So the less space that I have to bill you for, the more money that you'll save in the long run. And also, they're usually a higher caliber of equipment. If you go in and get a desktop box, you're dealing with a PC motherboard that was designed to be a home computer.
Right.
And the power supplies aren't as efficient. They aren't as designed for uptime and heat reasons.
And a lot of these servers actually have redundant power supplies.
Redundant power supplies and special server chipsets that are designed to perform faster for internet servers and also last longer.
Now, if you're a small business and you want to do, you want to sell things online, you offer these services with your servers already.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have to bring in their own hardware.
Yeah,
when would they need to do that?
Well, it's really a choice kind of right out of the chute. If you're interested in buying your own hardware and maintaining your own hardware and being responsible for the warranties and repairs, then you just bring it in, get colocation, internet service from your ISP. Or you can actually go to most places like us and you can actually rent hardware. So you don't have to pay for the box, you don't have to worry about warranties, you don't have to worry about support, you don't have to worry about hardware. All that's covered inside of a monthly recurring fee.
Okay.
All right. Cool. Well, we're not going to be able to take any more calls, actually, today, which is fine because we're running out of time a little bit. But let me just put out the URLs a little bit more. If you're interested in the services that GNI or Global Net Optics, Inc. can provide, you can go to we're going to go to GNI Hosting, right? That's what we want to go to.
It's a little easier to say.
GNIHosting.com. Of course, you can learn about a little bit more about the show and such from our website, geekspeak.org. We are hosted through them, and I just got to say that it's really a pleasure to be able to call TechSupport and get things up and running. But to answer your question, Sean, about why people want that is that for larger companies, it's important for them to be managing their servers themselves, like banks, for example, where they have to do all the security model inside. And it's fun to go into the cold room. I mean, that's basically where... So
it's a pretty amazing room.
It really quite is.
It's really fun. Like, if you're in the path of the fans, you're freezing. And yet if you stand behind the computers where the cold air is going in, it's been heated up and comes out, it's not like a blast burn. It's not like a sauna. At the same time, it becomes, oh, it's comfortable. I can actually just, like, stand here without a sweater.
It's nice.
It's that difference that... That's why the cooling is needed.
It brings up a good point about the energy costs in your data center and the inefficiencies of converting all that electrical energy into heat as a byproduct. And I think at Intel Developer Forum, we saw more and more discussion from Intel in particular about increasing the efficiencies of their chips.
Oh, my God. They came up with that concept?
I know.
It's amazing.
Sean used to work for a company that actually focused completely on that, right?
Yeah, Transmeta. But I'm not there anymore. I just thought I'd put that out.
It seems like a really low-hanging fruit. It'd be easy for everybody, but...
It's something we really need to focus
conserving
on.
Energy.
Well, you know, if you want faster chips, you're just not going to see them anymore because they're too hot. They
and too what hot. That translates into from Intel at a marketing perspective is longer battery life, which everybody wants.
Laptops.
It's hard to complain about that.
But it would also be a big thing for hosting facilities. I mean, a lot of your costs are dealing with the power coming in and the cooling systems managing the space. Of course, the bandwidth as well.
Unfortunately, applications, when they're being written now, need more performance-based processors. So the demand from the software side is for the more powerful processors.
Right.
While we're trying to save power and energy. And heat is just a byproduct of how much electricity has got to go through that chip. And chips right now, the way that they're designed, is they get faster when you put more voltage into them. So that's kind of the conundrum. This catch-22 right now. How do we get more power out of a chip without putting more power into it?
Yeah, power management is going to be important, kind of turning your chips into hybrid, you know, like a hybrid vehicle. You know, you've got to conserve that energy.
This program is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering extensive selection of computer and electronic parts, as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. The geeks this morning were Sean Cleveland, Drew Meyer, Miles Elam, and Josh Weiss. And our guest was and is, well, still for the next minute and a half, is Derek Wise, decorated Marine and President and CEO of Global Net Optics, a hosting and Internet service provider. Derek, I want to thank you for coming over the hill and talking with us today on GeekSpeak.
Anytime.
Wow, anytime. Yeah, next week, you're there.
Hey, maybe we should design some kind of way to trap that heat energy and turn it into something cool.
How about better performing computers?
Hot dog grills.
Great. There we go. Free hot dogs.
I'd like to learn how the military trains you for this sort of thing. Because that's where you got all your expertise, right?
Unfortunately, you're not going to hear that.
Someday we'll bring
today.
You back on and talk about that.
our producer is is Maggie Cleveland. Actually, she's not our producer anymore, but they did have a baby. My sister's having a birthday today. I want to thank you very much, Adri, for being a great older sister and happy birthday. And thank you all for listening to GeekSpeak. To those of you that called in, thanks for making GeekSpeak what it is. Without you, it'd just be geeking out. And who wants to listen to that? GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence, and he's used by permission. And next week, we already have a show, and I can't remember what it is. It's something about digital photography, because next week starts the month of digital photography on GeekSpeak. So if you want to know about digital photography, we're here every Friday at 10 a.m. on KUSP. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, Santa Cruz, KBDH, San Ardo, on the web at kusp.org. This program is supported in part by our community of contributing listeners. Become a contributing listener. Visit kusp.org. And thank you for your support. Coming up next is The Open Road. I'm not sure if it's Matt or Dean, but it'll be great music until 1 p.m. when it's again great music with Charlie Lang and his show Two Steps from the Blues. For KUSP and for GeekSpeak, I'm Lyle Troxell.